Yes, he was part of the 1960s boy band phenomenon, the Monkees. It seemed so huge at the time. In 1967, the Monkees outsold the Beatles and the Rolling Stones combined. All the more phenomenal then, in a way, is Nesmith's subsequent career. Of course, he was pretty well known before the Monkees, actually. Singer-songwriter, he went on to be a music video pioneer. He invented MTV. Film producer, philanthropist, philosopher, intellectual, think tanker, to name but a few of his aspects. His new album, a track from which you just heard, is his first in over a decade. Raise, it's called. That track was called Zip Ribbon. He came to New Zealand, actually, Mike Nesmith, in 1975, performing several concerts solo around the country. Joins me now from Monterey. Hi, Michael, how are you?
Good morning.
Very nice to hear from you.
Thank
I'm
you.
Just looking at the cartoon that's on the cover of Raise.
Drew Friedman.
Yeah. It's pretty cool, but it ends up, you know, you're travelling around in flash cars and being applauded by masses of people, but in the end, your hunger is satisfied by sitting in a little Eldorado, not the car, actually, but more like a little paradise, and your car's got a plant growing out of it, and you've gone back to nature, is it?
I think so, yeah. I think probably not the nature that a lot of people think of, but certainly nature, and it's a good thing because I think that's probably my last album. I'm pretty well done with it.
Really?
Yeah.
How come?
Well, I think it's been a long and very fruitful time. Music has been inspiring to me, and I love it, and I love to play it, love to perform it. There just comes a time when the emphasis shifts, I think, and for me, and I'm at that point. It's time to move on.
So. Mind you, you've had so many strings to your bow going on for so long. You know, it's not as if you've been devoting yourself to album after album. You've been doing so many other things. Couldn't you squeak out a few more albums?
Well, there's always been the tension to do another album, and that tension's gone. So I'm grateful for that. I'm happy about it, and I think I'm proud of Raise. I think it's a nice swan song, and I'm going to just leave it at that.
It's a nice album, actually. How would you describe it if you had to?
It was an arduous process. It was very difficult for me. It took 5 years, and that's one of the ways I know that it's the last one, because it just, you know, getting longer and longer to make now, you know, give you a clue that maybe you should focus on other things. And in that 5 year period, I just was lost. I wandered from creative node to creative node, from point to point, not really knowing what I had, not really knowing where it was going. It was very confusing. There was a moment at which everything was kind of laying around the room, and I looked at it, and it all sort of came together. That was a big relief. I thought, oh, okay, I see what this is. This is a journey. It's a journey of a soul. It's a journey of a. It moves from the city to the country. It has a nice internal logic, a nice internal dialect, and so I'll go ahead and piece it together now and put it all together. And so what's come out is Raise. It's partly instrumental and partly vocal, and it starts off kind of in an urban environment. It ends up in a pastoral one, and in some way it also reflects the arc of the last 5 decades of my life.
Whoa. I'm thinking the prison here, because you're always into sort of journey concept things. I mean, of course, a lot of people will remember in, what was it, the 1970s, and it was an album and a book, a sort of multimedia project called The Prison.
Right, a book with a soundtrack.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I've kind of held on to that piece because I think there's substance there. I sort of botched it in the first comings out because I just didn't have the depth to get the ideas across. Untrained, uneducated, and so I was, you know, kind of hacking away at it. And as time's gone on, and I've gotten better as a musician and better as a producer and better as a thinker, then the prison refocuses. I'm in the process right now. I've gone back to the multi-tracks. I'm remastering it, remixing it. I've tweaked the book, I've revised it a little bit, so I'm going to probably re-release that at some point.
Gosh. You know, it's interesting that you want to go back to things.
Isn't that interesting? I remember a guy telling me that there was a man here who had a commercial advertising company. His name was Stan Freeberg, and he had a very good career, and he would show up at the recording studios. This was in the 60s and 70s, and he would go back to work that he had done in the 50s and pull them out of the vault. Had absolutely no use for them. These were commercials of products long since dead, and he would go into the studio and tweak them and think, I just want to get it right. I just want to get it right. I think everybody sort of has a little bit of that, and his way of going back and doing it. And I'm sort of the same way. I kind of want to go back and see if I can get this right or tweak that or make that better. You know, revisions and rewrites is really very much a part of an artistic life. And typically you think, well, I'll write this book, then I'll rewrite the book, then I'll get a couple of editings on it, and then I'll rewrite it again, then I'll put it out, and then I'll be done with it.
Yeah.
But it's not the way with me at all. What it is it's a lifetime of work. It goes back as long as I've been working. I think, I'm going to keep revising this until I'm no longer visible on the planet, and get it as good as I can as I go on. Now, that's, you know, that's qualitatively different than generating new material. So it's a you have to put it in certain perspective in your creative efforts, but I think it's very important, this whole business of rethinking, rewriting, revising, and really honing in on the ideas until they get clearer and clearer and well burnished.
In order for you to get full satisfaction from that revisiting, do you need an audience with an historical memory?
No.
Do you not?
No, quite the contrary. I prefer audiences who just don't have a clue who I am or what I'm doing, because the discovery part is one of the most fun parts of it, and of the creative process. Not only as the artist when you discover it, but also watching other people discover what you've just dug up, and when people bring preconceived notions or prejudged ideas into that mix, it softens the experience. It doesn't make the experience valueless. I mean, look at classical music. That's it's a lovely experience. But it does take away that bit of discovery. So I really like a fresh new face and new crowd.
Except that you've had such an interesting life and you've contributed such a lot to the whole kind of lexicon of music, that it's good to have that in your head when you're watching or listening or reading stuff that you're doing now for the audience, I would have thought.
Well, it could be, but you know, what happens is that an audience without a preconceived point of view, or even as an artist without a preconceived point of view, you start to see things that the preconception would cloud. So I don't know that that by bringing those preconceptions that it enhances the experience. I'm more of the mind that they might you don't really need them as a touchstone. The experience really happens in the present, in the moment, and it's that moment that you want to take away with you. You know, I was talking to my wife the other day. I said, why can't we have these eternal moments? What do we think about anticipation? Do we think that it's a good thing or a bad thing? Did you, when you were a child, did you anticipate? She said, oh, gosh, I anticipated my friends coming over for dinner. I anticipated Christmas. I anticipated going to the store. I anticipated going to school. It was all just, oh, wonderful, this is going to happen. This is going to happen. I said, well, what about those moments where you're just in the present, where things are just wonderful right now, and everything is just couldn't be better? Is that a better state of mind, do we think? And she agreed that it probably was. You know, her touchstone was swimming, and everybody has that. There's that kind of sitting on the bank of a favorite lake or whatever enduring moment you can think of, where all of those other things just sort of fade away. That present tense is such a potent state of mind that I take it over all others.
I suspect that the answer is going to be now, but what's been, do you think, the best, the happiest, the most fulfilling time of your life?
Well, you know, there it's peaks and valleys in terms of the whole experience. You can't help but kind of roll back over it, and some memories are good and some memories are bad.
Tell me about this bit then. I was talking to Barney Hoskins the other day, and he's written, among his many books about the music industry, he's written about the LA music scene in the 60s and 70s, and your name came up, of course, in the context of the Troubadour. Was that a good time? It seems an incredibly busy time.
Well, it was, you know, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can't get away from that. And yes, I have some wonderful memories that will pop up from time to time. I also have some demons that will pop up from time to time. Things I'd like to go back and make right.
Oh, but, share that with me.
Well, I can't call them to mind. You know, just on the
that's a shame.
Just on the spot. But I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
The spirit of it. The spirit of it is that we have these wonderful memories. If I were to start right now saying, I remember once when I was everyone would move closer to the radio, and then there was this guy. But you know what we would be doing? We'd be trafficking in nostalgia, and it's that nostalgic twist that I think is a barb on a hook. There are many people who thrive on nostalgia, who love nostalgia. I'm just not one of them. I find it very, very off-putting.
Yeah, that's interesting, because we are at a stage, I think it's the baby boomers, you know, people are absolutely riveted with it. And in fact, a lot of the music around today that is popular with this generation of baby boomers is you know, reminiscent of. And I guess that's what you're trying to get away from, huh?
Well, yeah, it's not so much trying to get away from it, although you say it correctly. It's more of a question of keeping the window clean so you can see what's coming.
Yeah.
You know, you start stacking up tchotchkes and knickknacks and so forth, and you just really don't have an idea when something new comes in the door, just exactly where it's from and what its basis is. You have to. For me, I I'm always trying to work from tabula rasa, and I'm always trying to see. You know, what happens here with an absolutely clean sheet of paper, without the past affecting the present? How can I move into that space? Because as an artist, and really just as a thinker, that present tense is where I find all of the power of life.
I do want to ask you about your mother, though.
Mm, do.
Because your mother sounds a fantastic character. Let me summarize what I know about her, and you can tell me whether I'm wrong or right. Your parents divorced when you were four. They were in Houston, Texas, and she went to Dallas, solo mother, worked as a secretary, made the discovery of what we'd call twink liquid paper, and became a multimillionaire.
That's right.
She mixed it up in a kitchen.
Right, right. Well, there's a big the fascinating part of the story to me. Well, there's so many fascinating parts of it. One of the more fascinating parts is it's a long way from coming up with a good idea in the kitchen and turning that idea into a multi-million-dollar international organization.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, basically uneducated on her own until later in life, and then married only for about 10 years. She was able to marshal her resources and her ability to think creatively into finer and finer avenues and until they really began to pay off for her. And it was an extraordinary exercise in clear thinking.
How old were you when she was mixing it up in the kitchen?
Well, 12 and 13 is kind of when the idea hatched. She was a commercial artist by night and a secretary by day, and so at night she would, you know, as a commercial artist, when you, this is in the 50s, would lay out a commercial advertisement for a local bank or whatever, would paint out any mistakes that you made because you didn't have the option to do it any other way. And about that time, the electric typewriter was invented. She was moving from manual typewriter to an electric typewriter. She kept making mistakes on the electric typewriter because the keys were so sensitive. And she thought, well, I'll just paint these mistakes out. And she just connected a magic dot. You know, I'm painting out mistakes in my commercial art. Why can't I paint out mistakes as a secretary? Well, it turned out there were a couple of reasons why she couldn't. First of all, the paint didn't match, so she had to color the paint. Second of all, the paint wouldn't dry very quick, so she had to kind of teach herself a little chemistry and come up with a way to make the paint dry. Third of all, her first brushes she got were just basically watercolor brushes with metal sleeves around the brush heads, and the metal sleeves would rust inside the paint, turn it all yellow, ruin the batches. So she had to learn, you know, production techniques and all of those things, which she taught herself. And as each one of those steps occurred, the idea became more and more clear to her, more and more fully formed in her thinking, and she began to just move along. Then, just according to the logic of events.
Extraordinary enough in itself, but she went on to do extraordinary things with her money.
Well, to some degree. I mean, she died the year after she sold the company to Gillette.
Had she not set up a foundation in the interim there?
She did. She set up a foundation in the interim, but I think she had bigger plans than what she was able to achieve while she was still alive. And so that's what I mean by she... I don't know that she completely fulfilled those goals, but yes, the foundation she set up still operates today. I run it, and it's quite small, but she set it up to encourage the arts and ideas, and particularly to benefit women. And she started that in the mid 70s.
Do you
it was fun because in one way, because just about the time she took off and began to get her financial feet under her and get really airborne, I landed in the middle of the media frenzy with the Monkees television show, and my whole career took off. You know, you say that the Monkees outsold the Beatles and the Rolling Stone, you know, combined. Well, we did that for about a month. Monkees, well, very, very short-lived.
Short-lived. But there was, there was really good music attached to the Monkees, actually. I mean,
it was, yeah.
Who, Pleasant Valley Sunday, you know, Carole King.
Yeah, there was some, you know, it was a good creative team together. And but the point is that she was sort of in her ballistic arc just about the time I was in my ballistic arc. So we were waving each other from our respective ballistic arcs. And, you know, we were very close. We talked every day of her life until she died, and was very had a lot of interesting and deep and long, far-reaching conversations. She was an extraordinary duck.
You were already relatively successful on the LA scene anyway before you joined the Monkees.
Well, yes and no. I mean, you know, LA is really a town for the very young. LA works really well from about 15 to about 35, and after on either side of that curve, there's a steep fall off. And so what I did was I arrived in Los Angeles when I was about 20, just right when I was 20, and so I was right in the target window, right in the hot pocket, and I was able to and I was playing my guitar and writing songs, and people were singing my songs, and all the other friends that I had who were all my same age kind of owned the city. This was, of course, in the 60s. We didn't own the city like the Beatles owned London, but the whole youth movement was coming together. By the time I had gotten to the Monkees, my career was just sort of hovering. I hadn't really gotten airborne. I hadn't really had any particular successes. So it's a bit of a reach to say that I had a flourishing career before the Monkees came along, because it really was the Monkees that was a catapult.
Except that presumably Linda Ronstadt would have recorded different drum, which you wrote, whether or not you'd been in the Monkees.
Yes,
I mean, you were.
Yes, the songwriting career was a was a real revelation to me. I had no idea when I started playing the guitar and writing these songs, because I couldn't really read music and I wanted something to play, so I just made stuff up, that other people would find them interesting and want to sing them too. And when other people would sing my songs, it was just the most magical experience for me, because I just love to hear people sing my sing the songs that I wrote. First of all, they would realize something about the song that I hadn't realized, and second of all, they were 9 times out of 10 much better at it than I was. They could sing, and they had great productions and so forth. So Linda was one of those people. When I heard her sing Different Drum, it would just raise the hair on my arm. I loved singing my songs, but not as much as I loved hearing other people sing it.
I mean,
that was going on pretty good for me before the Monkees started.
Yeah, you became a country rock pioneer. I mean, you put that music on the map and First National Band and so on. Presumably, it was a very good thing then that the whole Monkees thing blew up in the end because you weren't allowed to do your own stuff. Because if the Monkees hadn't blown up, then you might have been a Monkee forever.
Well, yeah, a lot of the life of things that start like the Monkees is very short because it was a television show. So really, it's not going to go much longer than that. As it worked out, because it was so successful, I ended up having to buy my way out of the Monkees contract, which was fine with me. I was happy to do it because I did want to go off on a solo career, and I don't know that. I don't know how much longer the Monkees would have actually lasted. I'm still amazed at how much of the music is out there in the general consciousness and how well loved it is.
Yeah, it's the baby boomer thing again, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's very gratifying and satisfying to see that because there's some nice work there.
Now you pioneered again the music video, I think. Rio is credited with having the first real music video attached to it. It's 1976, is that right?
Right. Well, you know, it was... Kim, I fall backwards into these things. I don't really set out to do any of it, you know, like country rock. I didn't know what country rock was. In a way, I still kind of don't. Same thing with the music video. I got a call from a guy who ran a record company in London, and he said, I like the record you've made, Rio. I made it in Nashville. And, if you can make a little clip for us, a little promotional clip for us, we can get it on television over here, and that means a lot in Europe and in London and England because there's only one television station. This was, of course, in the 70s. And so if they play it's really like getting national exposure on radio. So I said, well, let me see what I can put together. And thus was born the music video, because what I did was I just couldn't bear the thought of standing up in front of a microphone and singing and having somebody take a picture of that. It just seemed kind of dull and silly. So I put together these different images, what we now think of as a music video. And when I took it over there, it was just greeted with cheers. And then when it went on to the air over there, it made Rio a hit. Every bit of which, I can assure you, was an absolute surprise to me.
Really?
I mean, very gratifying, but just an absolute surprise. It was in Australia that I was walking along. I was in the middle of nowhere. I couldn't tell you where I was, but it was very far from an urban center. And I was sitting at at the only place to eat in town, at a bar, and a man walked up to me. And he said, hey, you're Michael Nesmith. And I said, well, yes, I am. And he says, I know you. And I expected him to say from the Monkees. And he said, you made that video, Rio. And I was just stunned. I had no idea how far-reaching it was. He says, well, I really like it. I think it's a great pop clip. And I thought, pop clip? This is a good name. I think I'll use this. A pop clip. There's a lexicon here growing up around this. Let me just see what it is. So pop clips. I got home and I thought, you know, there's a symbiotic relationship between radio and records. Why wouldn't there be a symbiotic relationship between television and videos? So I made a show called Pop Clips where I went and dug around to see all the music videos that were out there in order to make a television show. Well, there weren't any. There were three, I think. So I made like 4 or 5 more, and myself, and I tried to get it on the air, tried to get it on television, and no one was interested in it until finally I hit pay dirt with a friend of mine who was senior management at Warner Brothers, and he says, look, we've just got a television transponder, which is a part of a satellite feed system, that's come unstuck. We had programming on, it's not working. Now we've got this overhead. We don't know what to do with it. We need programming for it. You know, you may have an idea here. Why don't you see what happens in the consortium that we've set up between Warner Brothers and American Express? So I went down and I took all my little music videos and all the research that I'd done, and I said, okay, here's the idea: music television, and it's 24 hours a day, and it runs on the cable channel that you've got that's sitting there idle. You guys have got a stack of really smart executives. You've got a deep pocket full of money. I think you can pull this off. And they said, great, are there all these videos out there? And I said, well, not right now, but there will be if you
make a space for them. Yeah.
And they said, well, can you put together something like a pilot? And I said, yeah, I'll make a pilot for you called Pop Clips. And so I came back. I made, I don't know how many, we did them in like half-hour segments, and they aired it on a channel that they own for children called Nickelodeon, and the needle just went off the meter. And so they said, okay, move back here, music television, Pop Clips, we're going to do it for real, we're going to put, and you can run it. I said, not in this lifetime. I'm going to stay out here on the West Coast and be a stay with the creative side of things, and I have other things to think about than running a cable television network. So send me my check, and I'll go away. That was the beginning of MTV.
Do you think the music video changed music itself? I mean, do you think music? It's an impossible question. I suppose. Do you think music would be different if the visuals hadn't become attached to it?
I guess the real answer to that is I don't know. I just don't know. It's a hard question to ask. It's a harder one to answer.
Yeah.
Maybe. It's just one of those things I couldn't say.
I just remembered that that the Monkees had a tour in which, in 1967, in which Jimi Hendrix was your opening act.
Yeah, one of the great pop ironies.
And the audience, you know, kept on saying, who are you? Bring on the Monkees.
Right.
I
love
that.
We remained, you know, Jimmy and I remained friends. I just loved the guy, and just days before he died, I ran into him in London. He had come into a press conference that I was having for one of my new albums, and just to lend the support, because by the time he came in to do the press conference that I was doing for one of my solo albums, he had become a mega star. He was doing 100,000 seat stadiums at that point, and it was such a lovely and generous thing for him to do, you know, to lend his celebrity and his fame to my little fledgling press conference. I really liked Jimmy. He was a good guy. He was not the right opening act for the Monkees, but
no.
he was really quite a fella.
Boy, I can't imagine anything that was more kind of discordant, given your audience of 12-year-olds, I suppose. You produced a series of movies in the 80s. In another incarnation, you went on to produce Repo Man, is possibly the best-known one.
Right.
Which was a fantastic movie.
Well, I think some people really like it, and other people don't quite get it. Yes, it still has a cult following. Alex Cox, who was the director of it, I thought was going to emerge as one of our preeminent directors. He's got a wonderful sense of movies. You know, when he went from Repo Man, he did Sid and Nancy, and I thought Sid and Nancy was just one of his better works, and up an order of magnitude from Repo Man. But I was lucky enough to get him just as he was coming out of UCLA, and doing Repo Man, was his first effort, and so it was one of those things. But I can tell you that the studio didn't want anything to do with it. They thought it was just an abomination.
Yeah, well, that figures. It's a sign of excellence, really, in those days, at least, wasn't it?
Well, at the time, you know, it was just so off the focus of what people thought should sell and how it should work. But it's proved itself out. I think there's real substance to the piece, and I think it shows off Alex, you know, as his beginnings in a really favorable light.
One of the things you've been doing is hosting a council on ideas, which involves bringing intellectuals together every 2 years, I think, and brainstorming solutions to global problems. Is that still going?
No, that ran through the 90s. We did that for a decade in the 90s, and it was really a good program.
What'd you do, run out of global problems?
Well, you know, that really wasn't quite the focus of it, but it goes to why we decided to shut it down. There was, what the idea was to create an interdisciplinary group of thinkers who could exchange ideas at a very high level and try to identify the most pressing issue of the day, so that it would tend to focus the people who are doing the heavy lifting and in the trenches and working things out on where they should be looking. It didn't work out that way. The first Council on Ideas was just almost a fist fight. It was one of those parties that you give where everybody shows up and nobody likes each other.
What did they? They fell out over Fidel Castro, wasn't it?
That's right. Ah. You know this story?
Yeah. Okay. It seems such an odd thing.
Yeah, well, I was all full of brightness and hope and optimism, and so I invited a woman named Mercedes Duarte, and the other one was Georgianne Geyer, and she was from Washington, D.C. I'm framing all this up in my mind, so I'm kind of stuttering through it. Just wanting to get these two ladies. So Mercedes was University of Texas, Third World Studies, emphasis on Latin America, and she was a spitfire. And Georgianne was Pulitzer Prize winner, Washington, D.C. establishment, but she was also a spitfire. You know, she was. And they were really polar opposites. And I thought, well, good, they'll have a lovely discussion. And so we're all standing around making small talk, which I learned never to do again. And so I said, Georgianne had just written the book called The Gorilla Prince, which was about Fidel. And I said, so Georgianne, just cut to the bottom line. Is Fidel a good man or a bad man? And Georgianne says, oh, he's a very bad man. And I said, really? And I look over, and smoke is coming out of Mercedes' ears. And she said, well, Mercedes says to Georgia, well, you can't know that because you're white. And that was it. Well, we were off and running. It was just a free-for-all after that. Wendy Wasserstein was there, rest her soul, and so was Lawrence Gross, Larry Grossman, and they were just referees for the rest of it.
Yeah.
So that was a lesson to me that I the next one was much more successful. As a matter of fact, that was a meeting that the participants reckon changed their lives. At least that's what they've said. And it went on from there. But as it got more and more famous and more well known, it became an object of press fascination. And as you know, what we observe, we change. And by the last one in 2000, it was a free-for-all. It was a madhouse. It was just like a big party. The wires were there, and the big magazines were there, and taking pictures. And you know, these were little walks that people would take around the property and talk to each other. I have had this wonderful image of Frank Gehry and Arno Penzias walking along the pathways there, you know, two real lions in their respective field. Arno's a Nobel winner. Frank was a Pritzker winner, architect, physicist, discussing. I thought, this is what the Gihan Foundation money should be for. And the next thing you know, we've got people taking pictures of these guys walking along. And no, this can't happen. This can't be the case. We can't have this is turned into some sort of a circus. So I shut it down. That was it. Mm. And now we're starting up. We're going to go to the next date with what we are calling the Magritte-Einstein Symposia. I've gotten it from the Brussels Free University, an idea from the Brussels Free University, and it's going to be much more close to the vest, much more close to the public, and we'll see where it goes.
That seems so unfashionable, Michael, you know. You're supposed to open everything up to the public. If you've got big ideas, share them. What big ideas are you hugging to your vest in the Magritte-Einstein Symposium?
Well, you know, it occurred to me that logic and reason are very powerful aspects of thought. They probably are most powerful aspect of thought. Now, this is not to eliminate passion in any way or intuition. I'm just talking about the way logic and reason has delivered so many good things to us. But the problem with it, and it's a big problem, is that logic and reason can very quickly go astray, because all you need is a wrong premise. And you can get this beautifully structured, logical, and reasonable train of thought, but it's from a wrong premise, and so you're going to end up in the ditch at some point. And scientists use, when I say scientists, I'm talking about particle physics scientists who are, have been taught a kind of classic closed system science, use their logic and reason very powerfully. And they use it to in a way that they validate and to some degree intimidate their thoughts to other thinkers. Artists use the same thought process, but they start from a different standpoint. Artists start from a standpoint of revelation. They start from a standpoint of inspiration and from something appearing to them that may or may not be true, and then they put they apply their artistic reasoning in back of it. So I'm thinking to myself, you know, these two people should talk, because the artist can learn a lot from the scientist's application of powerful reasoning, and the scientist can learn quite a bit from the artist's application of inspiration and revelation. Both have kind of tossed those key elements of thought process out, and if we bring them together, hence the name Magritte-Einstein, that maybe by each explaining to the other what their processes are in their latest and most active work, it might result in something good. So we're sweeping that together. We're working with a colleague of mine at the IAS at Princeton, and with the Gihan Foundation, we're going to kick it off next year.
Sounds interesting. Very nice to talk to you. Thank you. Michael Nesmith.